Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And I've got one of my favorite bass players and just one of my favorite musicians with Brian Beller. He was on the show not too long ago. He has dyed his beard purple. So that I noticed that, man. Very good.
that was special. This is to differentiate this one from the
last. You know what happens sometimes? Like, just something comes up, or someone's got to go, or they didn't expect it to go so long, and they're like, "Hey, can we finish this? You know, tomorrow, next week, whenever." And I'm like, "Yeah." And I'm like, and they're like, "Well, people are gonna know," and I'm like, "So." Because they like some of them, they wear the same clothes, and I'm like, it doesn't matter. It's funny.
I think it would be funny if they like went hard the other way, like they're wearing like a plaid something and glasses and like a wig for the first one, and then the second one they like shaved their head completely bald and like weren't even wearing a shirt.
I would love it.
You guys didn't even mention it. Like you just kind of continued the interview like nothing was ever happening, you know, and just let's see what people say.
I would love that. I wonder if people would notice. That would be interesting. We're doing a test
now. At that point, performance art.
AB split test. So I wanted Brian to come back on the show because I mentioned this on his last interview. He recently came out with a record absolutely phenomenal. And it's you know, Brian's kind of like a prog rock fusion guy. This record is off the charts, like just great music. I'm not going to sit here and say is it okay to say it's not a prog rock record?
It actually, you know, I consider it to be a prog rock record, which is
really
funny that you talk about kind of prog and fusion because, you know, this is my third studio solo album. And my first two, I think as an artist and a composer, I really didn't know who or what I was. I grew up listening to classic prog, you know, like Pink Floyd and Yes and Jethro Tull and a lot of the classic prog bands. But I also listened to a lot of fusion. You know, and we all, especially if you're bassist, you listen to a lot of Jaco and Chick Corea Electric Band and John Scofield. So I think, you know, as a bassist solo artist, I kind of fell into that weird thing where I was like, well, I got to like, you know, show my jazz fusion chops because that's what instrumental music is all blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, I hadn't really done any of like the jazz homework, like the real deep jazz homework. So it was kind of a bit of a hodgepodge in terms of which way I was going. And the only reason I bring that up is because when I started Scenes from the Flood, I was like, you know what? I want this to be like a classic double progressive album. You know, maybe it doesn't sound like Jethro Tull with flutes everywhere or anything like that. There's different, more modern sounds, but I wanted it to feel like one of the classic double progressive albums, like Pink Floyd, The Wall, or like Yes's Tales from Topographic Oceans. And so I embrace the progressive genre identifier. I self-identify this album as progressive, so that should clear that up.
All right. In that case, under that context, yes, I'll agree with you 100%. When I think progressive, most of the progressive music, I listen and love everything you mentioned. There's like a little further out there, like a lot more classical oriented. This is just fucking straight ahead great rock and roll, man, with some great, I mean, this was, I'm no, I'm not, I'm, this was, I mean, yeah. I asked Brian to come back on here because I thought this record was so good and it needed to get out there. This wasn't like he said, "Hey, Craig, can you hook me up? Can I come?" No, I asked him to please come back here. God's honest truth, because it's
not,
a great.
Not that I'm above that, but I'm glad that you asked me back.
Oh, it's great. So in case you didn't see, what I would encourage you to do is listen to Brian's last interview. It just came out about a month ago. But in case you didn't check him out, let me give you like a 2-second cliff notes on him. He's a talented multi-instrumentalist, sideman, and solo artist. He's most well-known for touring and studio work with Joe Satriani and with the Aristocrats. He's maintained a career as a bassist, composer, solo artist, writer, and clinician for over 25 years. By the way, that comment you made in the interview, I had a lot of people write comments about that. Like, I loved hearing about this guy's 42-year overnight success. It was really cool. He was also a sideman playing, recording, and touring with, and typical on multiple projects over many years. People like Steve Vai, Death Clock, Mike Keneally, who he played with for 17 years, Nick Johnston, Jane Getter, who Jane was on the show, Nick's coming on the show, Darren That's Charles great. From Godsticks, who was on a while back, Eros Ramazzotti, Marco Miniman, Janet Robin, who was on the show, Dweezil Zappa, and many others.
So, you had Janet Robin on the show. That's so awesome.
She was a trip and a half. She was really funny. Anyway, man, thank you for coming back on. Let's talk about this record. First of all, congratulations. This is work, man. This is not an easy thing to put together, both from a musical standpoint, writing, musically. It's absolutely awesome. And like I was thinking about it, you've put out more music as a sideman, quote unquote, than some bands do in their entire career.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you count, I suppose, well, definitely with all the side recordings I've done, if you count them all. Yeah, I've done a lot more of that than I have of myself as a solo artist. And I always thought of myself, especially when I was in my 20s and my early 30s, as only a sideman. I didn't think I was even capable of writing music. I remember the day that a melody first appeared in my head, I was just like, surely that's a song that I've heard somewhere. Someone must have written that, because I don't write. And this is all the way back in 2002. And so that's what got me to do my first solo album, View, which came out in 2003, and I was 32 years old. And then I did another one in 2008 called Thanks in Advance. And at that point I was 37. And then in 2013, I started to have the initial formative ideas for something that I knew was bigger than anything I had tried to do before. I was already putting out stuff with the Aristocrats at that point. We were working on Culture Clash and touring that album. And I had just joined Joe Satriani's band. I was doing a lot of road work, but I started hearing this music that was definitely not Aristocrats music in my head. And I felt like I had something big to say about it, but I just wasn't quite sure what. So I just gathered material and demo. Like, well, I didn't even have time to make the demos. I was just writing down stuff as I thought of it. And then I would make a little text cheater file. And then if I heard a melody, I would sing it into my iPhone voice memo. And then I had a list of song titles, because I always write to the title first. I come up with the title and then I think, oh, this is what I want it to be about. I had an album title and I had a concept. And I just started filling in the jigsaw puzzle pieces. And by 2015, I kind of had the whole thing mapped out. And by 2016, I could sing the whole album to myself in my head. And I've mentioned this in interviews before, so I don't want to repeat myself necessarily, but I had the whole thing, with a couple of exceptions, maybe a few minutes here and there scattered throughout the record, kind of just sitting in my head by the end of 2016. And then in 2017, I took an entire year off, no touring, no nothing. I barely did any other work. And all I did was make these 18 demos.
Oh, wow. Which,
you know, it was 88 minutes of music, 18 Hell yeah. songs. And, you know, it was a really long, weird, isolating process. Strangely enough, it was very much like what we're all going
to say.
I didn't sleep regularly, and I barely left the house for like a year. It was just I just went all the way into the composition process. And the funny thing is, you know, here we are on the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. Here's my trusty guitar that I used for the demos. As you can see, there's no...
Is that like a Fernandez Strat?
It's a Hohner.
Oh, wow.
And I got it from my friend Rick Masalam, and it was just this beater Strat copy that he had laying around. And he just gave it to me. He was just like, here, you can have this. And I've been using it to make, you know, Aristocrats demos in the past. Like, all my Aristocrats demos are done on this guitar. And I sat down and started kind of working out what I wanted the guitar to be on all of these demos, you know, with two solos as exceptions. I played all the guitar in all the demos.
Wow.
And what ended up happening was, okay, so I got through like with a year and I've got these 18 song demos in the whole album. I can listen to the whole thing down. It sounds like the album. I'm like, this is it. Now I just got to go record it for real. And I started working with my mix engineer, Forrester Saville, and you know, yeah, of course we started going in and replacing important guitars, but there was a lot of guitar stuff that he was like, it's rhythm guitar stuff, man. You don't need to redo that. Just send it to me and I'll reamp it. you know, it's all we, you know, it's edited, you know? So we ended up keeping a lot of my rhythm guitars on
that's
the album.
That's amazing, man, actually.
And even some leads. There are two songs that have my leads on there. One of them is called Bunkistan and one of them is called As Advertised.
Dude, Bunkistan is one of my favorite songs on the record.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was all, we ended up keeping, first of all, for the album, we kept all the bass from the demos. Every single note. We didn't change anything. You know, I sat here recording it into an MVox Mini, you know, and we kept all the bass.
That's awesome.
Just talking about guitar, you know, I am a terrible guitarist.
I would not say that.
Here's the thing. Okay. No. So I could sit down right now and I made this miss. This is the thing. I did this on another podcast where we started talking about the songs that I played guitar on. And they were like, oh yeah, and Bunkistan and As Advertised, you know, those riffs are really cool. And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, sure. And I picked up the guitar and I tried to play them and I sounded like a third grader because I can't really play guitar. You know, I mean, I can play it like a bass player.
That's funny to see that, man.
Or if I hold a pick, it looks terrible. It's like.
That's great. That's actually a pretty nice looking guitar, man.
What's that?
That's actually a pretty nice looking guitar.
This is actually a decent guitar. It's a really, really versatile Strat copy. But the thing is as a songwriter, what I discovered and eventually embraced was that you don't really need to know how to play an instrument in the classic sense in order to write songs in today's age. So if I really knew, like I knew what these guitar parts wanted to sound like in my head, I've been fortunate enough to play with all these amazing guitarists. Yeah. I know what good guitar sounds like. Just because I can't do it doesn't mean I don't know what I want it to sound like.
Yeah.
And so then I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, well, if it was going to be it, I would have to put my finger here and I would have to put this finger here and then that would have to go there. And now I fingered a chord and now I have to remember what that is, even though I have no idea, kind of like I've never made this shape before. And then it goes to the next one and the next one. And then I got to sit there maybe for about 10, 15 minutes until I put it together and it sounds like someone can actually play it. And then I hit the record button and then it's there,
awesome.
90% there. Edit out the rough edges. There's the part. Move on to the next part. And it sounds like someone played guitar. It doesn't sound like a real, real, real guitarist. But if it's a rhythm guitar part especially, or maybe if it's a kind of a quirky kind of lead melody with a different kind of sound, then you keep it. So all I could say to people out there, you know, it's like, of course, there's more technical facility in guitarists than ever before. And a lot of times I was handing off my demos to like people like Joe Satriani or Guthrie Govan or all these great guitarists. And you just have to check your humility at the door when you do stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in other cases, you can just pick up an instrument and just learn to play it just well enough to communicate your idea. And you never know. It might be a keeper.
Man, I want to just repeat a couple of things that you said because I want people to take that away. And then I have a question for you. You started writing because I think a lot of times people look at this, they don't realize, you know, the 10,000 hours kind of thing, you know, you're not an expert in something. It only takes 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. I think you're such a great example of that. I mean, you started you didn't start writing music till 2002. In 2013, you started hearing this. In 2015, you mapped it out. And in 2016, you had the entire thing mapped out. And then in 2017, you took a full year off. I mean, that's a really, admirable. That's just like, that's a normal journey. I think people, for some reason, I mean, sure, you have these extremely prolific, brilliant one-off people that, oh, I just sat down and I wrote the whole Coldplay album in 20 minutes. You know, I've heard Chris Martin say stuff.
Yeah.
That's not by and large how shit happens. This is probably much more the norm. And I give you so much credit for like, you know, just doing your journey.
Well, thank you. It starts with, this is going to sound maybe a little hoity-toity, but I think it starts with actually knowing what it is that you want to say and having something to say and having a story to tell. I'm a big believer in the narratives of albums. And that's why I'm such a Pink Floyd fan. Right. You know, I think that there's a world when you listen to a Pink Floyd album, you enter a world of emotion and storytelling.
That, I agree.
That they create more effectively than maybe any other band I've ever heard in the rock genre, which is of course why they're so popular. Why are they, I mean, there's a debate over whether or not they're progressive, but if you call them progressive, they're undoubtedly the world's most.
That was my only hiccup, because this reminds me of a Floyd album. I never referred to them as progressive, so that was where I had to make the leap.
Yeah, but
this is like a Pink Floyd record.
Floyd progressive. Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes and.
Yeah, yes and.
You know, yes, they're progressive, and they're so much more.
Yeah,
but I just, you know, I realized that I had a story to tell, and the story that I wanted to tell in this album was the story of the loss of illusions. You know, disillusionment, the idea of a very normal human journey, I think, that starts off with certain fixed idealistic and optimistic views about the world and about humanity. And then maybe through some hard experiences, you learn that the world works sometimes that way and often it does not. And the wheel of life can be capricious at times. And you have to find, you know, this is the story of a protagonist. I actually made it individualized in my mind, even though I didn't publicize it this way, that there is a story of someone who goes through this process. And then there is a cataclysmic event about halfway through the album. And that's what the song The Storm signifies. That's the eighth song, second to last song of the first half. And then the rest of the album is kind of coming to grips with the aftermath of that and what you know, how can you recover? What can you rebuild? What do you still believe? What do you realize doesn't work anymore? What do you have to let go? And, you know, what are some of the painful things that a human being has to go through in order to kind of relearn how to view the world in a way that works for them? So that's like super heavy stuff, right? You know? But that's what I was thinking before I sat down to kind of write the song titles. And so the song titles came one after another, and I realized I was trying to tell a story that progressed in a certain fashion. And then it became easier for the music to arise inside the individual song contexts and then inside the individual album side contexts, because I've envisioned it as a four side double album, double vinyl, like the albums I used to listen to when I was a kid. And then finally, the overarching story. So yeah, it does take a while to go all the way into something like that. And then once you feel good about your concept, then you got to get into the nuts and bolts of actually making the demos, you know? And so we talked about guitar, but I like programming drums, and I programmed them very specifically. Bass is bass. I'm lucky because I was a keyboard player as a kid. I played piano starting at age 8. So I feel very comfortable on keyboards. It makes up for my lack of comfort on guitar.
I've heard you play keyboards, man. You're very, very solid keyboard player, man. Yeah.
Thank my classical teacher for, you know, for instilling good values in me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little bit obsessive too. Maybe you have to be. I don't know. But like, you know, I spent how many thousands of hours was it in that year alone when I was making the demos, let alone sitting there thinking about it all. And I would go on these long hikes, and I would sing the album to myself alone, like in my head, all 88 minutes over and over. And when I got to a part that I didn't really know what I wanted it to do, I would stop and think about it. And sometimes it would just show up in my head, and then I'd have to grab the iPhone and sing it into the iPhone, and then it would be there. So in the process of kind of being obsessive about your own artistic vision and journey, you inadvertently accumulate some expertise along the way. I became really good at making demos in Pro Tools. I didn't become like a master mix engineer or anything like that, but I became really good at making the demos with the tools that I had. You know, by month 8, 9, 10, 11, I had a lot of facility at it. And so I could make a pretty fleshed out demo on a complicated song. And that helped a lot, especially for the fourth side of the album with songs like World Class and Sweetwater, where I really needed to bring the plane in for a landing after a long journey.
Yeah. And plus they're such long songs, they sound great. Let me ask you this. Do you hear my cat through the door? This is amazing. He's so loud. What was the trigger? Cause that's a pretty heavy topic about disillusionment. And also props to you. First time someone's used the word capricious on the show. What was there like a trigger? like that you're comfortable sharing. Was there something that happened or that you saw happen or that you were aware of that prompted that, the whole theme of disillusionment?
Well, there's some things I'm not going to get into. I've brought this up before. You know, I think there is a danger of kind of going too far into that. You know, I mean, pardon me for anyone who's seen me say this before, because I know I've said it in a bunch of interviews already, but why do we love The Wall? Do we love Pink Floyd, The Wall, because we need to know every single detail about where Roger Waters' father's plane crashed in Italy in World War II? That's not why.
No, not at all.
Even though that's what he was working through, you know, for the last two albums of the Pink Floyd canon and The Wall and The Final Cut, it's obvious he was working through that.
Yeah, clearly.
So I think that there's limited utility in going too far into the personal details. But yes, of course, you know, you have to draw on something.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for artists to take breaks in between albums to go out there and live life and experience things so that you have a story to tell.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be autobiographical. It could be observational as well. So this album ended up being a combination of things that I'd experienced and also things I'd observed. One of the things I can talk about is, you know, in 2013, there were a lot of very, very positive and, you know, bordering on utopian views on what social media was going to do for humanity.
Really?
And yes.
Wow.
2012 and 2013, everything was still pretty super rosy about all that. And I had observed some human behavior and phenomena that was both, for me, localized and also generalized that made me think, you know, this could very easily go dark. And I'm not sure everybody sees that yet. But I would like to touch on this theme. And that's just one of the things that speaks into the grander theme of disillusionment that I was trying to get to. And then as I was writing it, the whole thing turned upside down. And suddenly
so dark.
And now it's like, you know, you barely even want to look at it, even though it's always there and it's omnipresent in our lives. So that was a bit of a jarring thing to realize while I was writing this thing about that it turned. Yeah. But then the other thing that I realized is that even though my the way that I wrote it had to be individualized in order for me to kind of go step by step through the album, I wanted to tell a story that could be processed and absorbed by obviously people who didn't have those experiences. But the idea that there would be a way of human beings looking in the world in a functioning society, and then there would be a cataclysmic event, and then everyone would have to kind of reshape and reorganize the way that they thought about not just their relationship to their world, but the way that other human beings reacted to this cataclysmic event. And would they still feel the same way about themselves and humanity after this cataclysmic event was over? And then once they found their footing, who's to say that the next storm isn't just around the corner? You know, here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
In our pretty, houses.
Yeah,
you know,
and top of it,
we have this, you know, and listen, I don't want to say this sounds very, very arrogant, but like, yes, I'm Nostradamus and I wrote an album about the future. You know, that's not what I'm trying to say.
You're not coming across like that. Yeah.
But I think there is a grand theme about human nature. And, you know, I'm certainly not the first one to grapple with it. Look at George Orwell, look at William Golding. I mean, like, sure. You know, there's real serious body of work around this topic, but this has really kind of driven the point home about, you know, what do we do individually and collectively when the plan goes to shit?
Yeah, man.
You know, how do we react? And are we the same after something like that happens, or are we not? You know, this is something I think for people. So think about the kids who are graduating high school right now.
Or college, yeah, I know.
Or college is shaping that. Or if you're a Gen Xer, you've lived through some pretty good times. Now you're living through some pretty weird times. If you're a baby boomer and you're 70 or 80, you've seen the world go upside down five times already.
Yeah.
So, you know, at some point, at some point you can imagine how a human being would take a slightly more, I don't want to say jaundiced, but like realistic view of the world and the way it works and the way that human beings interact with each other when things don't go according to the plan.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this unwinds. And unfortunately, I was really idealistic thinking, man, I hope people will be nicer and kinder out of this. But man, already you got people angrily marching in the streets on both sides. I mean, it's like, God, can you just, you know.
What is that? so explore that. What is that thing that human beings do that generates conflict on an individual, then also on a group, and then on an even larger scale basis? Why does it always go that way?
Oh, because it's rejection. It seems like most people have a hard time of just saying, hey, man, this is how I feel things should be. It's like, hey, this is how I think things should be. And fuck you if you don't agree with me, you piece of shit. Like,
well, you know, I just read a really, really great essay. It was actually a tweet storm. Let's talk to our social media about Lord of the Flies, which is one of my favorite novels ever. Yeah. And basically, you know, what the writer, the guy who was doing the analysis, saying,
who wrote that? Who wrote that?
I think that's William Golding. I think it's William
Golding. Right. William Golding, Lord of the Flies. Yeah. Correct.
And hopefully this is required reading for high school. So hopefully everybody who's watching this has read this book. If not, you have.
Is it still required reading? I don't think. Is it? I don't think they make you read anymore. Yeah. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the main, what people tend to take away from that book is that mankind is evil. You know, that there's something inside mankind that, you know, but what the guys doing the analysis said is that that's not really it. You guys are, we're all missing the point. The point is not that human nature is evil, because there is a desire for human nature to organize collectively for what they believe is the right thing or good. But a lot of the times those forces don't prevail.
Yeah, so the good intentions are, yeah, so they...
Why is, you know, why are our quote-unquote better angels not rewarded in the mass consciousness of human nature and the way things unfold? Why do the, you know, why do the bad guys...
Yeah, why do the assholes somehow seem to corral...
Why do they accumulate power? Why are they able to accumulate power, corral power, and wield it
and use it in a not good way? That's the thing, man. It's just like, you know, pissing on someone else's parade is never going to get you anywhere.
Right. And you know, this can very easily like veer into a very specific political conversation, but that's not really my intention.
Yeah.
It's because you can look at it from either way and feel oppressed. Mm. So my intention with this conversation and with the disillusionment conversation in general about Scenes from the Flood was to provoke a thought process of how do you find your way in a world where there are these elements of human, there's obvious example after example of human beings, both individually and collectively, you know, not always acting awesomely. And you have to find your way in this world and without kind of falling into the trap of, well, everything sucks.
Yeah. Cause that's not the answer either. If we're not
saying everything sucks, everything's going to suck.
Yeah. That's not the
answer. You have to find some other way. While acknowledging, at least, you know, according to the view of the record, while acknowledging that things don't really always go the way that you wish they would.
Yeah. It's interesting. My kids are much older. My oldest one's about to be turned 30, and my middle son is 28. And even though they're adults on their own with their own families, I still worry about this. Not worry about it, but it's so... As a parent, it's something I wish they didn't have to deal with, because I, you know, they're quite able to take care of themselves, but you never leave that, you know, you never change your role as a parent. Yeah. And it's, it's something I wish I had answers for them, and I don't.
So now what's the role of art in all this, right? You know, and in music, I mean, we're here, this is the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. You know, some of us are able to make some kind of living based on the idea that people really dig music.
Yeah.
That people really dig guitar playing, you know, that people, but, you know, in general, I would assert that it's not just because people want to hear someone go la, 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 or even on a guitar that makes them want to love music or buy an album or go to a concert. It's because they're having some kind of emotional response to it.
Yes.
They want to have again. having some kind of, you know, some emotional trigger, positive, negative, deep, reflective, whatever, that's rewarding for the listener. So, you know, there's value in entertainment, or else there wouldn't be pop music. Some people just want to feel good.
Yeah.
You just want to listen to a music, a piece of music, feel good. Great. I'm not here to judge that. And after all, 100 million YouTube views can't be wrong, right?
Yes.
So there's that. But, you know, as artists, we have choices. We can decide if we want to make something that's a little bit deeper, a little bit more reflective, and give someone a reason to kind of keep coming back to visit the house.
Yeah, man. And you did it.
That's what I was hoping to do with this, was to give something that if you kept coming back to it, if you listen to it over and over again, you can detect the melodic themes that weave through the record, which are story threads, and get kind of a deeper sense of what I was trying to say.
Man, you did a great job. One other question I want to ask you. Oh my God, my cat. Hang on. I'm going to let him in. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Oh my God. I heard you. Come on in.
Great, right?
He's like braying out there like a goat for like a half an hour. What should I ask you?
Hashtag goat.
Hashtag goat. What you took off for a year? What else? I know that must have been a pretty interesting year for you. Besides putting this together, what else came out of this during that time frame for you?
Oh, I got completion on some things that I had been sorting through for years.
Great.
Yeah, it was a great,
that's great,
very rewarding personal journey for me. And I finally felt like I had composed the album that I had been trying to write all along.
Yeah, man.
And so there was a feeling of immense satisfaction when I first listened to the demo album in sequence. And I even did the segues and everything like that. I mean, I made it so that it was like listening to the album, because I needed to know that the vision was there before I started asking other people to contribute to it. You know, I didn't want to, with something that big, I didn't want to ask people to start doing things and then like be like, oh, wait a minute. No. I really thought it was going to be more like this. I wanted to have all that shit sorted out.
Yeah. Well, you're like a total pro, man. You're super respectful of people's time. So, I mean, that's, you know,
you just try. I mean, especially with some of the people that I asked to do it, not all of whom were super, you know, big famous names like John Petrucci and Joe Satriani, but everybody's busy. Everybody's doing, you know, you don't want to waste anybody's time. You know, everybody's, I would assert that some of the people that maybe that you haven't heard of who are on the record are probably more difficult for them to squeeze into their schedules, you know, because they're just busy trying to make it all work.
Yeah. Let me ask you some more questions. Again, 11, it's 18 tracks, 17 originals, one cover. Who else, what other instruments did you play? You played bass, obviously, keyboards, rhythm guitar. What else did you play, and who else, what other special guests or what other guests did you have on the?
Well, there's your cat in the background. That's awesome.
Screaming, man. I was just like, drive me insane.
Good luck for the podcast. mainly I played, you know, guitar, bass, drums, keys. And the keys, I had a couple of keyboard specialists come in for, like, you know, really professional sequencing. There was one thing where I really wanted to have a song that sounded like it was kind of inspired by Donna Summer's I Feel Love. And
Madonna's, oh, man, what a great song.
Yeah, and Madonna's Ray of Light, which is inspired by that same song anyway. And I wanted like something with a really, really good, you know, and a good keyboard player, a pro could come up with that in 10 seconds. So I asked Matt Rohde to contribute that, and he was great. And then Fred Krohn, who's a TV soundtrack guy and a movie soundtrack guy, I asked him to help me with some of the soundscape things. But other than that, I played all the keyboards, and I knew that they were all going to stay. Obviously, I didn't play any of the drums, just programmed them. Got some great drummers, you know, Joe Travers is like my best friend, and I've been playing with forever, ever since Berkeley. He's on the meat of the album, a lot of the straight up rock stuff.
You talked about Joe. Isn't he the guy who got you connected?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's the reason I started with Weasel Zap in the first place and everything. So, And I love, to me, nobody plays straight ahead rock stuff with a fuller sound and a heavier groove than Joe Travers. He's just, you know, amazing for that stuff. And so it was him on a few songs. And then Ray Hearn, who is the drummer from Haken, really, really great progressive band, mostly British. I wanted someone who had kind of like a more modern sound as a counterpoint to Joe's very kind of earthy American rock sound, and to play not just the technical stuff like world class, but also something where there would be like a drone groove where it's just one thing over and over again, like Bunkistan, which is just this simple groove in nine over and over.
It's funny, simple groove in nine.
It is. Here, it's a simple.
All you advanced guys, oh, it's a simple groove in nine.
Yeah, it is. Radiohead writes simple grooves in odd time signatures. That's kind of the thing I was going for there. And then Gene Hoagland is an amazing, legendary metal drummer. I got him to play on the big, you know, the song The Storm, which is the big cataclysmic event, which occurs in the album. And he also played on this really, really fast, nasty song called Steiner and Ellipses, which is 2.5 minutes of just blistering extreme metal, which is kind of an homage to Devin Townsend because I'm a big Devin Townsend fan. And then there was another drummer named Nate Morton who is who's in the house band for The Voice, and he was in the house band for American Idol. And he's the guy who played on that Donna Summer inspired song. I wanted something that was like very pop, and he was perfect for it. So, I mean, that's just the drums. Guitars, this is not the Everyone Loves Drums podcast. This is the Everyone Loves Guitars podcast. I should have been talking about that. That's so right. Joe Satriani played on a song. I was writing it when I was on tour with Joe. I didn't realize that I was writing something that was kind of inspired by Joe's whole world of melody and groove and form. But when I listened back to the demo, I was like, oh my God, I've written a song that Joe Satriani has to play. And thank God he said yes. He didn't have to.
Yeah.
You know, and Joe, when I sent him the song, you know, he didn't just send back the melody and the solo, which I'd asked him to do. He sent back a whole arrangement. He sent back double tracked acoustic guitars. He sent back, yeah, he sent back harmonies. He sent back like, wow, you know, him playing a banjo and like all sorts of, like he sent back a whole, like basically he kind of co-produced the song, which was wonderful. It was really above and beyond. And he worked on it for a couple months, you know, not only, but I mean like on and off, he just kept coming back to it. He really takes that stuff seriously, which is just, I have such immense respect and appreciation for what he provided on that song. And it was really cool to get a kind of a raw Joe Satriani track. It was very, very aggressive, kind of pointy strat with a univibe on it. And so, you know, we had a lot to work with in the tone shaping and getting it to sit in the mix. And it was really beautiful.
What song was that Joe played on?
That's Volunteer State. Okay. That's like basically
the single.
It's the single. It's the first real song on the album. The first track one is kind of an overture.
Yep.
It's actually a flash forward. It's actually the end of the story. And then track two is the first real song on the album, which is the beginning of the story, and that's Volunteer State. And the
video on that was really good. You made that yourself, I'm assuming?
Yeah, well, you know, I actually
really well done.
I hired a couple of pros named John Luini and Arthur Rosato from a company called Chime Interactive, and they do Joe's you know, visual and social media. And so it was just one of those things where I knew I wanted to do a live action video, and I thought it would be cool to kind of leverage the whole team. You know what I mean? I wanted to go up to San Francisco anyway and do.
Is that where that drive was from?
That drive is kind of, it's weird. It's kind of hard to describe. It's like Northern Central California. It's just in some out of the way rural spots. We shot in a few different places. It's not really important where it was. It was just more about the beginning of a journey. You know, you watch the video, you could see it.
It's great.
So that was that song. And we shot a real old fashioned live action video. Who does that anymore? But I wanted there to be something.
It was really cool.
Around it that kind of honored the contribution of kind of Team Satriani to that whole thing. So that was really, really cool. And then that's only one of like 12 guitarists on here. I don't know if we have time to go through all of them, but like, let's say, do you know Mike Dawes?
Yeah, I had Mike on the show a while back.
Well, you know, there was a song that I wanted to write on acoustic baritone, which is inspired by Janet Fetter, and we'll get to her in a second. But I had a baritone, and I tuned it to open B7, And I just did this weird, this was one of the only songs in the album I didn't know what it sounded like before I sat down to do the demo. And I just kind of played some chords and played a couple melodies and just went where my fingers wanted to go. And I added some Tibetan singing bowls, and I had a very atmospheric piece called Lookout Mountain. And I heard Mike Dawes play, and I thought, oh my God, this is the guy. And his contribution on that song is just, it's so epic. Yeah. His recorded acoustic sound is so beautiful. Him and that guy, I think it's Josh Clark is his engineer up in Wales where they do everything. It's just an unbelievable thing they have going on there. So that was wonderful. And the vibe was just perfect.
He's he's such an easy guy to get along. Yeah. And he's only I think he just turned 30. He's really more mature. And he's like an old soul, man. He's a
prodigy.
Yeah, he really is.
Of course, John Petrucci was amazing on World Class. If you've written an 89 minute album and you've got the climactic song essentially, or you're on side four and you're trying to bring this whole thing in for a landing and you've got a 9 minute progressive epic song, who's going to play the guitar solo on that song? You need someone who's going to really be able to carry the weight of something like that. And that's a vibe. It's not just playing. It's not just tone. It's an attitude. It's a whole thing. And John Petrucci is that guy, obviously. Yeah. So he played a great solo on that. But the real props also on that song have to go to Neely Brosh, who's another great guitar player and has her own solo material out. And who, she plays in the style, I would say, of kind of like Vi, Satriani, Petrucci, the guy. She's an Ibanez player. And she can really get around. She works really hard. She's got great technique, great tone. And I gave her basically the hardest guitar part of the entire album, which is the melody of World Class. And she killed it. So that was really great. And there's someone who, maybe some people know about, maybe some people don't, Mike Keneally, who's my long-term friend, I had him play lead on my first two albums. This album, I kind of employed him in a different way. I had him play acoustic on the song Sweetwater, which Guthrie plays the lead on. Thank you. And I had him play the kind of the riffing guitar on that extreme metal song, Steiner and Ellipses, that I was talking about. So I didn't want that song to sound like a modern djent metal tune. I wanted it to sound rougher and angrier with jagged edges. And, Keneally, he doesn't play metal traditionally because he didn't grow up listening to metal, but he can play metal. He just does it his own way.
Yeah.
And so
he does everything his own way. He's really
exactly. Yeah. And it made that song style. Really, really dangerous, which I really, really liked. And of course he can play anything. Teddy Kumpel is this amazing.
I know Teddy. You had Teddy on here?
Yeah. Teddy plays. So there's a song called Always Worth It, which is one of the bigger songs of the first half of the album. Mm-hmm. Griff Peters, who's a longtime friend of mine, plays the melody. And he also orchestrated the song. There's a lot of melody orchestration that he contributed. It's a really, really remarkable contribution.
Is Griff he's in Texas, that guy?
No, Griff is in Escondido, San Diego.
Okay.
And nobody sounds like him. And then there was a point that halfway through the song where the song takes kind of a hard left turn and suddenly becomes very angry.
Yes.
When it was sweet up until then. And I've heard Teddy do his solo thing. And sometimes he plays this kind of squonky, almost kind of like sarcastic sounding solo lead breaks. And that's what I wanted. I wanted something that just kind of had a little, just something to make you squirm. And he knew exactly what to do. It was perfect.
How do you know Teddy? That's so wild. He's in New York.
I know Teddy through Saul Zanana. You know him?
I know who that guy. I know who he is. Yeah, I know who he is.
He did a lot of work with Adrian Belew. And when I was in Nashville, that's how I met Teddy.
So right. Okay. That is wild.
Jamie Kime. Great.
I know Jamie. I had him on the show.
For The Storm, I wanted a solo that kind of had a bit of a Frederick Thorndahl, Alan Holdsworthy, kind of vibe. And I've heard Jamie do his own version of that really fluid, angular, kind of out half diminished thing. And sure enough, he came in and he actually played on the demo. And while he was doing it, I was just like, I know this is the keeper. I know this is the solo. I'm just going to keep it. And I did. Guthrie.
Yeah.
The song Sweetwater, which is the last full song on the album, which is this big anthemic, slow 6/8 guitar ballad. We worked on it for 8 months.
Oh, wow.
we were so, Guthrie and I will, when we have time to work on something, we really get obsessive about it. And we don't always have that time when we are with the Aristocrats. But in this case, we went over and over what sound it was going to be. We're like, oh, you know, it should be kind of stratty. Maybe it should be kind of Gilmore-y, you know, like, let's try this sound. Let's try this sound. And maybe it should swing like this. And maybe the solo should be like that. Bottom line was, we worked on something for 4 months. We brought it into mix and we both listened to it. And we were like, nope.
Wow. So
that's not it.
Back to the drawing board.
And we scrapped the whole track.
Wow.
And we started over. We went back and we were like, that dirty clean Strat thing, it doesn't really sound strong. It doesn't sound right in the tune. And it didn't really sound like Guthrie either. So we just said, screw this. Let's instead of doing kind of like a, you know, a Fender vintage amp model, let's try a Friedman instead and do something that's a lot closer to the Victory stuff that he uses, you know, on stage. Mm. And that much more saturated sound ended up having the right sauce. But, you know, it was agonizing to get the track for that because, you know, he's all alone there. It's a huge open moment. You've got 85 minutes into this journey and it's just Guthrie carrying the whole thing home, yeah. Which of course is what I wanted him to do because he's so amazing. But we were really happy with the final product, but it was the very last thing to finish. The very last. Yeah. And God, you know, Darren Charles plays rhythm guitars on The Storm, and I got him because his metal riffing sounded so great on the God Sticks album, Face the Rage. That song didn't sound right until he was on it. Also, Jake Howsam Lowe, the guitarist for Pliny, is on The Storm. For all that really, really sharp-edged riffing stuff, he sounds great. Of course, he could do so much more than that, but, you know, he was great on that. I'm sure I've forgotten a guitarist.
Dude, this is like a good...
I have forgotten a guitarist, and it's maybe one of the most important guitarists on the album, and it's Janet Fetter.
Yep.
So...
How do you know Janet?
Well, I know Janet through Mike Keneally. We played a show. This is how it started. Janet Fetter's engineer at the time.
You mean Janet Robin or Jane?
No, Janet Fetter.
Angles and Exits.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Janet Robin, I somehow got hooked up with her in the early 90s in LA when I first moved here doing side gigs with her. And I played her role. That was super fun. That's a whole other story. But Janet Fetter is a... classically trained, prepared baritone guitarist based in Denver, who I met because her engineer at the time, Colin Bricker, who owns a studio called Mighty Fine Studios, was opening his new studio in 2000, was a big Mike Keneally fan, and invited the Mike Keneally band to come play the opening of the studio. And Janet picked us up at the airport just as a favor to Colin. And we didn't know that she had her own artistry and that she had this own really, really, her own really, really cool and unique way of approaching acoustic guitar at the time. But her and Mike Keneally developed an artistic relationship. And then when we came through in 2005, she opened for our band in a set with her and Mike Keneally just improvising. Just doing nothing but improvising for like 20 minutes.
You say we? You mean the aristocrats or
no?
Satriani?
This is the Mike Keneally band.
Oh, Keneally. Okay. So Mike opened for Mike opened for himself.
Exactly. Mike opened for himself.
That's awesome.
And then I was completely fascinated with Janet's artistry. I went out and I got all her albums, and I was just a big fan. And then I gave her my music, and then we just kept in touch. In 2015, she came out with an album called This Close. Which I love her other stuff. There's an album called Speak Puppet, an album called Songs with Words, which I listen to a lot. But the album This Close absolutely blew me away. It was recorded on that super high res digital Sonoma sound system, and it kind of sounded like a cross between Bill Frisell and Nine Inch Nails and Pink Floyd and something completely indescribable as played by on acoustic baritone that was prepared in certain ways. Like you would have like a split ring on one string and a roach clip on another string.
Yeah, she does
resonate in all sorts of strange ways. And I was just entranced by this album. And I remember thinking when I was working on Scenes from the Flood, I want my album to sound this good. I want it to like just be so inviting and rich and feel this good. And there were some moments there where it was just soundscapes. And I was just hypnotized by it. So, the song Angles and Exits is a song on This Close. And I realized that it would fit in a certain part of the sequence and that the messaging of those lyrics would work with what I was trying to say in that spot. And then I realized that if I sang it an octave down, that I could sing it, even though I'm not a singer. And I just wanted it to be a very kind of like open, almost disarming, slightly uncomfortable, intimate vocal. Not trying to show anybody that I'm going to be the world's greatest singer or anything like that. Just that I was the one that had to convey that moment in the album. And
your vocals, and that, I had a comment here. I mean, your vocals are, I thought your vocals were great on there, man. Honestly.
Well, you're very kind. You know, I
no, it was really cool.
Well, you know, despite that one song where he sang, it's a really great album.
No, it sounded great. Man, you know what? It's interesting because not everybody's Paul Rogers.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be Paul Rogers. That's not the standard. It's only Paul Rogers. You know, your voice, it was great. Your vocals were great on that song. It was perfect.
Well, I was really emulating what Janet was trying to do on her song. If you listen to the original, which is on this close, the original Angles and Exits, you can just hear how intimate it is. And it's almost, it's almost uncomfortable how close you are to her when you're listening to that song. And that's what I wanted it to sound like when I was doing that, you know, and it's not an accident that, you know, that song ended up being 9 minutes long. I tacked on this big kind of epic ending to her original arrangement. And I told her, you know, that it's not an accident that if I was emulating, essentially there's parts of this album that emulate The Wall in subtle ways. And it's not an accident that song ended up at the end of side three.
Her song.
For people who know how The Wall is sequenced,
Comfortably Numb, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I wanted there to be a sense of that grandeur in the end of that song, because the end of side three going into side four is a very, very dark place on that album. And that's what I was trying to convey. So, Janet, but I didn't leave Well Enough Alone by just covering her song. I also wanted to collaborate with her, which was a lifelong dream of mine. And so we did so on the last track of the first half of the album, which is called The Flood, which is the closest thing that this album has to a title track.
Yeah.
And it's just piano, a series of synth pads, and then layers of Janet doing baritone guitar and fretless guitar, and then other indescribable kind of sounds with the guitar and various devices that she has. I don't want to give them all away because some of them are trade secrets. And it's a purely, there's no drums. It's just 5 minutes with four different movements through the song, of a soundscape and melody and a vibe. And it's basically the aftermath of the storm, you know, like all the kind of wading through the destruction of what just happened before you have to get back to whatever it is we're all going to get back to when something like that happens.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most rewarding things that I've done ever artistically. Was to do that with her. And both of us, we listened. I remember, because, you know, her world is very, very different than mine when you listen to her albums. It's just much more open space and there's a lot more ambience because not every song has drums. Some songs are just her guitar. That song really sits right in between our artistries. And we were both just...
That's nice, man. So you had a great...
We were able to pull it off and have something that spoke to the thing that we had wanted to do for, you know, at least 10 years.
That's great. Where did you so this was recorded basically whoever had to bring in tracks, they recorded it in their studio and sent the tracks in, or was there any?
It depended on the artist. I mean, you know, for recording Ray Hearn in London, you know, I wasn't going to go to London. So I sent the tracks, for Gene Hoagland and Joe Travers, the drums, they were in Los Angeles. I brought them into United, which is the old Ocean Way, I brought Joe into NRG, which is where, like, you know, I think Rage Against the Machine and Red Hot Chili Peppers and all sorts of rock bands recorded there. They have a great room there. And that's just drums. For the guitars, it was all over the place. I mean, you know, some of the guitarists recorded their stuff at home. I know that John Petrucci recorded his bit in the middle of the Dream Theater sessions for Distance Over Time.
That's wild.
Yeah. So he's like, he texted me. He was just like, hey, man, this is the sound I've got up for the album. You're getting the real sound. I'm like, yes, thank you. Joe Satriani did it at his home studio. Rick Musallam, he's a guitarist I forgot to mention. He's like my best friend. Oh my God. He's on the texture on so many different songs, including Always Worth It and Angles and Exits. He basically came up with the whole background texture for that. I recorded him in person at studios around LA. Jamie Keim was in my apartment. You know, Darren Charles was remotely in
Wales.
London. Mike Dawes was in Wales in his studio. For Janet, I flew to Denver and I recorded it in her environment. Her and Colin Bricker, the guy who introduced us in the first place, his studio was still a new studio now. So I went in there. There was a really, really old piano in there, like a 100-year-old piano that I was hoping to find somewhere. And it just happened to be sitting there. So I recorded that there with Janet there in Denver. And in my for Mike Keneally, I went down to San Diego to his home studio, which is Double Time, where some of his classic stuff like Boil That Dust Back was recorded. So it really depended, you know. Some stuff was remote, some stuff I was there in person, and then some stuff I did myself.
With a project this big, what did you learn from this experience as far as either about recording or maybe like about yourself or anything else?
Well, what I learned was that I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to completely embrace my obsessiveness. And when I say that, you know, I'm really, really passionate about everything that I do kind of artistically and musically. And so sometimes that shows up as like an intensity that I think that it's not always easy to be around, you know, like I'm on stage. I want the monitors to sound really, really good so I can deliver the best possible performance. You know, I'm listening to an album. I want it to sound as good as it possibly can. I want my own performances to be as good as they possibly can. I have high standards, but the thing is, you know, you can work on something forever and it'll right. never ever be done. You know, it's the old phrase that, great art is never finished, only abandoned.
Yeah.
Right. But I felt I had pulled up short in the recording and mixing of my previous solo albums. And with the Aristocrats, you know, we're moving really fast. Oh, hi. We're moving really fast. We have to get it done while we're together to a certain extent because Guthrie lives in London.
Yeah, because you're not.
And
yeah.
We're not a Dropbox band. We get together and record together. So in this case, I swore to myself that I wasn't going to stop until I thought it was perfect. And that resulted in 3 years of conceptualizing, 1 year of demoing, a year of tracking, and then 9 months of mixing.
Oh, wow.
And thank God for Forrester Savill, who is not only a genius, but an extremely patient genius.
Sorry, man. I love that. This is why I don't let him in here. Hang on a second. Sorry. All right. Oh, my God. Okay.
Your cat was moving the microphone around.
You have 15 minutes of fame here. Sorry, Brian.
That's okay.
Like I always want him in here, but I always remind. It's like having an infant or something. You know,
yeah.
He's gonna break stuff eventually. So 9 months of mix.
Yeah, 9 months of mixing, and Forrester Savill, like I was saying, he's not just a genius, but he was a patient genius. He knew how to ride my ebbs and flows of when I would really be zeroing in on something and how we worked on the most minute details. I was operating. People say that you can't hear under 0.3 dB, you know, moves and mixing. That's bullshit. You can hear it. You can hear it. If you listen on good sources, you can hear it. And it makes all the difference sometimes. A subtle difference in the shift of the EQ of the rhythm guitars or the overheads of the drums or just, you know, when you're dealing with textures and atmospheres that are this complex, every little bit counts. And so I remember the moment when I was listening. In the end, we were in the master sequence listening to it. There's three things left. There's two things left. There's one thing left. And I remember it was about a year ago. It was early May 2019 when I listened to the whole thing straight down and it was perfect. I was like, oh my God.
That you were finally satisfied. Hindsight 2020, would you have done anything different?
No.
Okay. That's great.
And I can't believe that I'm saying that. There is potentially one mix move in one song on the vibraphones in one moment where I might want to make one EQ adjustment. But I mean, like, really, this is, I am so, so deeply satisfied. And I hope that every composer and every person who wants to make an album has this feeling at some point.
Yeah.
You know, they say you should never be satisfied with your work. Once you are satisfied, then you've lost the plot and, you know, your creative. That's bullshit,
to be honest.
That's
with you,
bullshit.
Man. That's almost saying you should never be happy.
You know what that is?
I shouldn't.
I'm telling you, that is bullshit. So you want to be happy. Be happy.
Yeah, you
want to
be happy, of course.
Yeah.
That's great. The album, I was shocked. And every time I listened to it, that's what I was like, how is the mix on all of this? You know, it's like Dark Side of the Moon. It's like you listen to it, you're like, how the fuck is that possible that the mix is this clean on all? It's not like, there's like so many moving parts here, and you have the same thing, and the mix is just phenomenal, man.
I'm telling you, everybody who's listening to this and wants to make a big epic album or whatever, and they're wondering, they need that guy who's going to help them bring this huge plane in for a landing. Just go find Forrester Savill. He's the I cannot say enough about
him. He's the world's most patient engineer.
an absolute genius and a leader in his field. And he's not just a mixer. He also gets all the way down to details when it comes to very slight edits. If we hear something at the last second, we were shifting stuff around. You know, I mean, you never know when you bring everything up and mix and compression and everything. If you suddenly hear a part that like sticks out that didn't stick out when you were tracking, he does everything and mastering.
I was going to say he mastered this as well.
He mastered it too. Yes. I mean, we were operating at such a level of detail that we were basically mixing and mastering at the same time.
Yeah, that's what
I can't say enough. He's my hero.
On Satriani, you said, does the guitar in Volunteer State.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great... Anybody, I would encourage everybody to go watch the Volunteer State video. It's really, really good. You know, it shows you my own neuroses. I'm watching that, and what am I thinking about? Oh, my God, he's eating so unhealthy. All those snacks. That's my own nuttiness.
If you watch the progression of the video at the beginning, it's like all fruit, you know, and it's all healthy stuff. And then like, you know, day or two into the drive, it's like Lay's potato chips. And
Skittles or
rolls.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite funny. The last five songs of that of the record, from Angles and Exits all through the end, it kind of sounded like one suite. Was that how it was intended pretty much, or?
Well, the four sides mm-hmm. are intended as suites. Okay. So, you know, even though on a CD it would be two discs.
Right.
And so you'd get part one and part two if you want to look at it that way. It's really intended as four parts.
Okay.
You know, the first songs 1 through 5, songs 6 through 9, then songs 10 through 14, and then songs 15 through 18. So Angles and Exits is really meant as the end of
You said
the
comfortably numb.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's why there's a very, very kind of quiet interlude right before it, which is, you know, I mean, I did a series of posts about some of the hidden parallels to the narrative of The Wall in the way that side three goes into side four. And that's where it actually moves through that. It'll take an hour to explain all that. So I don't want to do that. But Angles and Exits concludes side three. And that arc starts with Bunkistan as advertised in Army of the Black Rectangles as this kind of slight crescendoing kind of anxiety. And then it all releases with The Outer Boundary, and then Angles and Exits kind of draws that story to a close. Side four is meant as a suite. And so it opens with this very ambient kind of slowly building piece called The Inner Boundary. And then that sets up essentially the end of the album, which are these two gigantic songs and then an epilogue. And you know, World Class is the first one, which is the 9-minute tune, which is the Eastern flavored.
Yeah, you had some like Indian raga type of stuff in there. It was really great.
There's a sitar player named Rashib Singh, I saw him on YouTube covering Animals as Leader songs on sitar.
Oh my God.
And then he had his own band called Mute the Saint, was it? And then also he has a new band called Sitar Metal. He's a great, you know, a rock flavored sitar player, and we did those tracks remotely. He recorded them in India, where he lives, and so it's him and Paul Cartwright on all the violins on World Class, and Neely Brosh on guitar. They're the three lead instruments on that. Then in the background, you've got me on keyboards and rhythm guitars, and then you've got John Petrucci for the solo, and then Ray Hearn on massive drums,
yeah,
and Christopher Ellis on percussion. I wanted, there needed to be something that like showed you that like this is the climax of the story, it ends up actually being a false ending. It's not the, it doesn't end the way that you think it's going to. It builds up to this big thing, and then it goes to the five chord, and it just ends and just leaves you hanging. And that sets you up for Sweetwater, which is the album's real ending ballad. And that's Guthrie on lead guitar, Mike Keneally on acoustic guitar, Joe Travers on drums, and then me on keys. And that song, you know, gives you that feeling like, here we are, we're finally at the big, open, glorious ending, and Guthrie plays the guitar solo that's going to bring us all home. And then at the very end, it doesn't go that way either, and it just takes this kind of strange, dark turn into the last song. And then, I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but it leaves you in a slightly uncomfortable place. It's not where you thought you were going to end up, which is kind of the point of the whole album.
I like the title of the last track, though, Let Go of Everything. I think that's a good thing for everybody to do, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I can let go of everything. Just relax.
Yeah. And, you know, in the context of this story, it was really letting go of your illusions about the world.
Yeah.
And human beings don't want to do that. You know, you have these fixed values, and there's things that you think you're right. And when you're presented with evidence that maybe what you were thinking either doesn't work or it's not right, or the evidence shows that it doesn't work on a grand scale, or more importantly, it's not working for you. You realize the hard way that something, that way of thinking or a way of being or doing isn't working. And you have to just kind of like, and you don't even know what's there to replace it. All you know is you just have to stop doing this. And in order to stop doing something, you have to kind of stop thinking in a certain way.
Yeah.
Because the thinking that generates the actions. All there is to do is just to let it go. And sometimes you don't even know what's behind the next door until you let go of the thing that you're hanging on to so desperately, because who are you while you're still hanging on to this thing? At least you know.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. I love that. I love Sweetwater. It's just the guitars on there are just really beautiful, man.
Thank you.
Beautiful melody line.
And well, Mike Keneally's acoustics sound great on there, and those were all really specific voicings, and not all of them were guitar friendly. So Mike really pulled extra work there. So I appreciate his contribution a lot. But you know, Guthrie Govan, I mean, like, what can I say about him that hasn't already been said? After all that work that we did on the melody and making sure that the phrasing and the tone of it was all right, you know, finally it was like, okay, Guthrie, let's do the solo. And of course, he sends me, you know, he could just crank out amazing solo after amazing solo all day long. That's what he's born to do.
That's what he's born to do.
He doesn't think at all when he's soloing. He just feels it completely. And just, so he sent me a solo all the way through. I'm like, oh, that's amazing. Like, how about we just like, you know, take like 2/3 of the way through. What if you went in this direction? And then he played something else that was amazing. And I was like, well, that's it.
Awesome.
It happened very, very fast.
Is this, now that you've done this type of record, which is like, let's call it classic prog rock, do you think this will show up more in other Brian Beller material?
Well, I don't think there's any going back for me to like pretending that I'm some kind of fusion artist.
Right.
And, you know, you could find material on my first two albums where you listen to it and be like, really? You know, that's who I was then. And maybe there was something I was trying to do with that. Maybe I was trying to prove to myself that I could do it or something. I don't know, but I don't think I'm ever going back to that. And frankly, I find myself wanting to create and play music with more space these days, not less.
Awesome.
What I do with the Aristocrats is pretty active and pretty dense. And that's always, that vibe is always there for me in that world. But with my own solo material, I don't think I would ever make a big double progressive. There's no point in trying to
out-big
this album. That's ridiculous.
There's no need for that.
when it was done, I kind of realized it's like, wow, that's like, I'm never going to do something this big again. I'm just not, because that's not the way that.
And that's okay. Like, nope.
What's the point? So what's the next album? It takes me a long time to recharge in between albums. I mean, like, my last solo album was 2008. So it's a long way off, whatever it is, but I have a feeling it's going to be even more open space and more atmospheric and even more melodic and less dense than Scenes from the Flood was.
Well, in 2032, if I'm still doing this show, I would love to have you on again to listen to it.
You know, I'm so grateful that you have me on. And it's so funny. The guitar really is the driving instrumental force behind our genre. It's just the way it is. People dig rock music because a lot of people dig guitar.
Yeah.
And so I, as a bass player, have been fortunate enough to play with some of the world's most amazing guitarists. And I thank God for it every day.
Yeah.
I got to play with all these people. It sounds like it was gratuitous that I just was like, oh yeah, I got an album with Joe Satriani and John Petrucci and Guthrie Govan.
No, I don't think it sounded like that at all.
But it can. It's just like, oh, look what he did. These are just the people that I've been playing with. So of course,
man, you don't need you don't need to apologize or have an excuse for that. Good for you.
I appreciate you saying that. But what I'm trying to say is that it's not lost on me that my ability to reach a lot of people with this album is because of the guitar. You know, there's bass enthusiasts out there. And of course there's drum enthusiasts too, but really it does kind of come down to the guitar. And one of the things I didn't realize that I was doing when I made this album was I was kind of making this big celebration of the guitar in our genre with all these different people. It really is just kind of like a guitar smorgasbord. In addition to all the other thematic and melodic things that I was trying to say along the way, it just ended up being this collection of amazing guitarists. So,
yeah, but let me tell you, this is a collection of amazing songs. This is really well-written album, really well put together, man. The patience that you and the discipline that you exercised in mixing definitely came out. It couldn't sound any more perfect, man. And I really congratulate you to put something together this epic. It's not an easy thing. People don't realize. I mean, this is a fucking work, man.
Thank you. Yeah, well, man. The benefit and the burden of having a brain like mine is I'm just not sure I know any other way to do it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you were saying I'm obsessive, you know, you always want to be working with an obsessive guy.
Well, sometimes.
You know, but I mean, sometimes. Right. But I mean, that's, you know, you don't want to, you know, no disrespect. I don't know if I'd be in a relationship with someone that obsessive. So your partner, whoever's over there.
Yeah.
Sure they're having a good laugh. Patience of a saint. But man, the record's perfect. Honestly, it's a beautiful record, man. And I'm so happy you made it. And thank you for making it. And I'll be listening. This will get me through many, many gym workouts.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, man, it's my
your audience about this album. It's really my pleasure.
Let me tell people where to get it. Okay, check out the record. It is amazing. It's Brian Beller. And Brian, again, is B-R-Y-A-N Beller. Scenes from the Flood. Man, if you are unsure, you want to just get a taste test, just go to YouTube and listen to the first song, which is amazing. The first single, which is Volunteer State. Yeah. Everything about that. So that's the one that Satriani plays on. And by the way, if you're expecting the normal Satriani on there, it's not. I think it was a little different than what he normally does. It was more in line with what he's doing now, actually.
You know what's funny is that to me, that's a really interesting thing. As people have different views of like what Joe Satriani does. To me, that was like a classic Joe Satriani thing.
Interesting.
Like, obviously Joe Satriani. Nobody else should be doing this. It's got to be him. And a lot of people were like, wow, you really got Joe Satriani to like do something different. And I'm like, are you sure? I mean, like, it just is. I basically modeled the form of that song subconsciously after a couple of songs on a previous record. It goes basically intro, A, B, A, B, and then solo section out, and it never comes back to the A, B. That's just it. And the melody and the chord changes, they all seemed like very classic Satch to me. But more than one person has ever said, just to show you, you can't tell when you're inside it.
Well, it sounds like his current record, Shape Shifting, I think it's called.
Yeah.
It sounds much more in line with his current record. For whatever that to me anyway, for whatever that's worth. Yeah. So check out the record and what I'd like you to do is go to brianbeller.com. Again, it's B-R-Y-A-N. And wherever, if you're going to stream the record, which we obviously, I'd like to encourage you to support Brian and buy it. He's got a very cool double vinyl set. It's a limited edition purple vinyl, and it's got a massive, like huge, why don't you talk about the program that's in it.
Exactly. If you go to brianbeller.com, there's a shop button, and it just, there's links to both to physical stores, which are active, not Amazon. It's Hello Merch. So they're shipping and both in the United States and also in UK, Europe.
There's two, awesome.
Two different shops. There's black vinyl. It's double vinyl, 180 gram. And there's this big, huge, full-size 20-page booklet inside. And this comes in, you can get it in black vinyl or purple vinyl. And I don't have that many of them left. I'm not repressing. I'm not just saying that, like, to get them out. The album came out 9 months ago.
Three so left. That's it.
Yeah.
No. Order now.
There's under 100 left. But, you know, the pressing is the pressing. And then
right.
And then there's the CD, if you're into that. There's the double CD with two 24-page booklets in there. And then, of course, there's also links to Hi-Rez Digital. If you want to purchase Hi-Rez Digital, which if you're going to get digital, you should get the Hi-Rez.
Yeah.
You can get that at Bandcamp, which is a great place to support independent artists.
Definitely.
And then, of course, there's still, you know, if you want to purchase through iTunes, you can do that. And if you want to try before you buy, you can always do the Spotify thing. I have the link there. I'm not a hater. I understand that it provides a service, and that's cool. But if you dig it, then you know what to do.
And follow Brian on social media. You have a Spotify channel too?
You know, I'm on Spotify. So if you click Brian Beller, the albums will come up.
Great.
So I'm on there, but I'm on Twitter. It's Brian Beller. I'm on Facebook, Brian Beller Bass. And I'm on Instagram as Brian Beller Bass.
There you go. What more do you need? Man, thank you so much for making this record. Scenes from the Flood. Awesome record, man. Really, really great. I was absolutely blown. I mean, it's not too often I say, holy shit, let's please come back. And I mean, no, seriously, it's brilliant. I mean, it's really good. I mean, I really appreciate how much work you did in there, man. This was like a work of art. And man, you deserve to bask in as much glory as you can get from it because it's great. So thank you as always, man. I appreciate it. Any final words or parting words or anything else? Anything else we could pitch?
Oh, you know, just stay safe out there. And I mean, you know, we've talked about Scenes from the Flood, you know, over and over and over again. But, you know, the Aristocrats, you know what, came out just a couple months before this album. So they kind of happened at the same time. So if for some reason you missed that train, you could go back and check that out too. The latest album, The Aristocrats, You Know What, is also.
Can they get that through brianbeller.com?
No, that you can go to the-aristocrats-band.com, and there's a store there. And of course we're on all the digital and streaming platforms as well.
Right on. All righty. Go to brianbeller.com. Again, it's B-R-Y-A-N. And thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. Great record. Thanks again for making it.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Check out Brian's new record, Scenes from the Flood. Go to brianbeller.com and hit him up on all the social media channels and his YouTube channel. Go check out that song, Volunteer State. It's amazing. And most important, especially in times like this, man, remember that happiness really is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your bass, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Brian, thanks for everything, man.
Thank you, man.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.